6. National Press Club, Washington, D.C., February 10th, 1945, 8:30 p.m. 800 American servicemen cheer patriotically as Harry Truman pulls up a chair and takes his place at the keyboard of an upright piano. It is Saturday night. The air in this crowded ballroom smells of cigarette smoke and male perspiration. There is a microphone to Truman's left, allowing him to banter and play at the same time. The soldiers and sailors are here for the National Press Club's weekly canteen, a tradition that entitles them to a few hours of free beer, hot dogs, and a stage show. Celebrities, generals, and politicians often make an appearance to serve food and support the troops. On one occasion, the entire Supreme Court stopped by, which led to the amusing sight of Justice Felix Frankfurter passing out actual Frankfurters. Top billing tonight goes to the man from Missouri. The applause for Truman suggests a mixture of respect and curiosity, for few in the crowd know much about their new vice president. But if Harry Truman is willing to pound out a few standards and tell some jokes, he is okay with them. Truman is not the only celebrity in the house tonight. 20-year-old sex symbol Lauren Bacall, star of the recently released film noir To Have and Have Not, is seated at a table right up front. She is the lupine focus of this all-male audience. Almost to a man, these soldiers and sailors have seen her performance opposite Humphrey Bogart and can recite her character's famous come-on. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow. Footnote. Based on a 1937 Ernest Hemingway novel of the same name, To Have and Have Not tells the story of a down-on-his-luck charterboat captain in wartime Martinique. The character of Harry Steve Morgan, played by the 45-year-old Bogart, soon falls for the young American traveler Marie Slim Browning, played by Bacall. The two generated a great deal of interpersonal chemistry on and off the set, leading director Howard Hawks to enlarge Bacall's role. Bogart's third wife, actress Mayo Metho, filed for divorce in May 1944. Bogart and Bacall married in May 1945 and would remain happily wed until his death from cancer in 1957. Their son Stephen, born in 1949, is named for the character in To Have and Have Not. End footnote. Harry Truman rests his fingertips atop the keyboard and jokes into the microphone, comfortable acting the part of the showman. In fact, playing piano to raise troop morale is one of many aspects of his new job that Truman enjoys very much. The political eunuch, as the vice president likes to refer to himself, delights in a schedule that consists of ceremonial speeches, presiding over the Senate, and a standing appointment for a glass of bourbon with the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, each afternoon at 5 p.m. Truman is unbothered by the fact that since the inauguration 3 weeks ago, President Roosevelt has virtually ignored him. FDR has not even spoken to his new vice president in person. Despite the snub, Harry Truman is having a whole lot of fun. The vice president has played piano since he was 10 and can perform Beethoven or Mozart from memory. Alternatively, Truman can launch into the ragtime tune Missouri Waltz, a song he despises, but which will no doubt elicit cheers from any Missourians who might be in the audience. Truman's song selection soon becomes inconsequential. In fact, as the sultry Lauren Bacall stands up and strides toward the vice president in high heels and a knee-length skirt, the lusty roars from the crowd make it clear that it doesn't matter whether Truman plays anything at all. With the help of some very willing soldiers, the young siren is boosted atop the piano. Bacall provocatively crosses her legs and dangles them over the edge, showing off her well-toned calves. Despite their 40-year age difference, she flirts with Truman. The actress smiles seductively, then reclines, never taking her eyes off the vice president. Truman is equally bold. Unflustered, he plays the moment for all it is worth, flirting right back with Bacall. Flashbulbs pop as photographers rush to take pictures of the unlikely scene, and Bacall turns her body to strike a new pose, and then another. Anything can happen in this country, marvels one appreciative soldier to a Washington Post reporter. Anything. Of this, Harry Truman, a former small-town haberdasher who has risen to the second highest office in the land, is well aware. The man with 62 days to live is being steamrolled. President Franklin Roosevelt sits in the pale Russian sunlight, a black cape draped around his shoulders. His face is gray, his lips are slightly blue, and there is fluid pooling in his lungs, all symptoms of the congestive heart failure that is slowly killing him. To FDR's left, also seated, is Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin. To Roosevelt's right sits the portly, constantly chatting British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. A cigarette dangles from FDR's left hand, but he lets it burn, knowing that the photographers now capturing this meeting of the Big Three will see the palsy that has afflicted his hands for months if he lifts the tobacco to his mouth. It is morning in Crimea, and the Big Three are wrapping up a week of meetings at the Black Sea resort of Yalta. Clearly, it is Stalin who has emerged from this conference as the big winner. "It was not a question of what we would let the Russians do, but what we could get the Russians to do," diplomat James F. Burns later told a reporter. Footnote: Burns was one of Roosevelt's 8 appointees to the Supreme Court, but he stepped down after less than a year, leaving the bench in 1942. The former U.S. Senator from South Carolina and good friend of FDR preferred helping the president run the war effort to the intellectual rigor of the Supreme Court. He would later go on to serve as Secretary of State and Governor of South Carolina. End footnote. The end of the war in Europe is now in sight. American and British troops have just thwarted Nazi Germany's last great offensive at the Battle of the Bulge. Led by aggressive American General George S. Patton and his vainglorious British counterpart, Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery, Allied forces are now preparing to invade the German fatherland. In the east, Russian troops have captured vast swathes of former Nazi real estate, including the nations of Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. In this way, American, British, and Soviet troops are squeezing tight the vise that will soon crush Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. In fact, Russian troops are now just 40 miles from Berlin. The purpose of the Yalta Conference has been to define the shape of the post-war world. But even before the conference began on February 4th, Joseph Stalin tilted the odds in his favor, beginning with the location. Claiming that his health did not permit travel, Stalin insisted upon meeting in this Soviet city. The truth is, Stalin feels fine. He is simply afraid to fly. Meanwhile, a visibly declining Roosevelt travels 6,000 miles by ship and aircraft, then endures an 8-hour car ride to attend the conference. His villa room is bugged, and the servants in his quarters are Soviet spies, meaning that FDR can never completely relax because he knows his every movement is being scrutinized. That is as Stalin designed it. For the brutal dictator well knows that if he gets what he wants from Roosevelt and Churchill at this conference, he will rule almost half the globe. Stalin's goals are straightforward. Return the Soviet Union to the same size and shape as the 19th century Russian Empire. His forces now occupy most of the northern Baltic to the Pacific expanse, and the ambitious dictator has no intention of giving up any captured territory. Yet there is one significant part of the former empire that Russian troops do not yet occupy: Japanese-held Manchuria in northern China. So, when Roosevelt requests that Stalin enter the war against Japan, the president plays right into the dictator's hands. Stalin agrees to fight Japan, but only after demanding that Roosevelt acquiesce to Russian designs on Manchuria. The Japanese and the Russians last waged war over this territory during a 19-month conflict beginning in 1904. Then it was Japan that emerged triumphant, sowing the seeds for Emperor Hirohito's global expansion. Soon, Stalin will have his revenge. Footnote: the reason for the Japanese invasion of Manchuria was its need for precious resources: coal, iron, salt, and arable land. The growing Japanese population meant that the nation was not self-sufficient. Manchuria offered the chance to gain access to those natural resources and relocate Japanese citizens to work the fields. The Soviet Union's intended invasion was fueled by a similar search for territory and mineral resources, and also by desires to regain lands lost in the Russo-Japanese War, particularly the warm water naval base at Port Arthur, install a pro-Soviet regime in Korea, and invade Japan itself. End footnote. Franklin Roosevelt waits patiently for the ceremonial photographs to be completed as Yalta finally concludes. Churchill's Great Britain is the biggest loser of the conference, and is emerging as a nation impoverished by war. Britain's former colonies are sure to seek independence at war's end. Roosevelt is content in the knowledge that the United States will remain a superpower and the world will be divided principally between America and the Soviet Union. Roosevelt has no problem with this. He likes Joseph Stalin and believes he can trust him. There is no reason the two great nations shouldn't work well together. Hands shaking, Roosevelt finally takes a long drag on his unfiltered Camel. He smokes at least a pack a day. Doctors have suggested that just 6 cigarettes should be his daily limit, but he ignores that order. Doctors have also advised the president to get 10 hours of sleep each night, limit his drinking to just 1 cocktail at dinner, minimize his salt intake, and relax for 2 hours each afternoon. He refuses. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is president of the United States. Medical advice that makes sense for ordinary men does not apply to him. But the stress and strain of Yalta are taking an enormous physical toll on him. Though younger than Joseph Stalin by a little more than 3 years, FDR looks a decade older. The photographers capture the shadows beneath the president's eyes and the tight set of his jaw. He came into the week tired and will return to the White House exhausted. After an arduous 7 days of haggling with Stalin, the president knows that the 6,000-mile return journey will be painful. Inside the 63-year-old Roosevelt's chest, his enlarged heart labors to beat. As Yalta ends, Franklin Roosevelt has unwittingly consigned millions of Eastern Europeans to decades of Soviet occupation. They will be deprived of basic freedoms such as unfettered speech and the ability to come and go as they please. All but forgotten is the fact that several years earlier, on February 19, 1942, Franklin Roosevelt himself decreed that tens of thousands of American citizens would suffer similar indignities. Under Executive Order 9066, authorities were ordered to intern Japanese Americans simply for being of Japanese heritage. They were incarcerated against their will, having committed no crime other than having ancestors from Japan. Thousands of Japanese Americans are placed in camps, one of the most prominent being located on the eastern slopes of the Sierra Nevada Mountains, where the Manzanar War Relocation Center rises from the barren soil of California's high desert. In summer, temperatures routinely rise past 100 degrees. In winter, brutal, freezing winds sweep down from the snowy peaks above, bending trees sideways and sending clouds of sand and dust through the air. Entire families have been rounded up and sent to live in these prisons for the duration of the war. They sleep side by side in barracks, surrounded by barbed wire fences. Armed guards look down from high sentry towers, scrutinizing their every movement. Until Emperor Hirohito surrenders, they must remain here in a place with no such thing as privacy. Showers are communal, as are the latrines, which lack the decency of a simple partition. These Americans are unsure of what their lives will be once the war ends, where they will go, where they will work, how they will rebuild. Yet, as the people of Eastern Europe will soon learn, they have no choice but to endure the hardships. Footnote: approximately 127,000 Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. End footnote. 900 miles southeast of Manzanar, in another windswept American desert, a team of scientists work feverishly on a device designed to cause mass death and destruction. Utilizing a revolutionary new technology, the team is locking down the final design of a brand new bomb. Shortly before World War II began, scientists discovered how to split the nucleus of an atom. The fission that occurs results in an enormous release of energy. Once news of this development leaked, weapons designers from around the world rushed to find a way to translate the research into a devastating implement of war. Since April 1939, the Nazis have also tried to build what scientists are calling an atom bomb. The Japanese, too, have been seeking such a weapon. Both have had no luck. Yet here in the New Mexican desert, after years of top-secret research, the American effort has finally moved from research to production. Now that Hitler is almost defeated, it is certain that this new bomb will not be used against Germany. Instead, Japan will be the target. The new device is still untested, but if all goes according to plan, B-29 bombers launching from captured Pacific islands will soon drop it on Japan. Estimates are that the explosive force could be equal to as many as 10 kilotons of dynamite, even though the bomb will detonate almost 2,000 feet above its target, never actually reaching the ground. But those estimates are merely a guess. No one knows the exact power of this theoretical weapon. It is not yet known which city or cities will be bombed, but a short list has been drawn up by Brigadier General Leslie Groves, leader of the Manhattan Project, as this deadly undertaking is known. To measure the full power of the blast, Groves wants each bombing target to be previously unscathed. This means that the people of Kokura, Kyoto, Hiroshima, Yokohama, and Niigata, who have largely been left alone by the American bombers up to now, may soon be in grave danger. In an historical coincidence, Lauren Bacall's appearance on the stage with Harry Truman unwittingly foreshadows an aspect of the new atomic bomb. Taking inspiration from her soon-to-be husband's film, The Maltese Falcon, scientists codename this bomb Little Boy. Footnote: The Maltese Falcon was a 1941 film noir that marked the directorial debut of John Huston. Humphrey Bogart played Private Detective Sam Spade. He was complemented by a stellar supporting cast that included Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Mary Astor, and Elisha Cook Jr. Robert Serber, the Los Alamos scientist in charge of codenaming the bombs, chose Fat Man from Spade's nickname for Greenstreet's character. The naming of Little Boy is more complicated. The Maltese Falcon was originally written by Dashiell Hammett. A third atomic bomb prototype, codenamed Thin Man after a separate Hammett story, was abandoned in July 1944. Little Boy's shape was smaller and more bulbous than that of Thin Man, which is how it earned its codename. At the time of the atomic bomb's development, Hammett was serving as an enlisted soldier in the Aleutian Islands, soon to be discharged at the rank of sergeant. Hammett would be called before Congress in 1953, suspected of harboring communist sympathies. He refused to cooperate and was blacklisted, making it impossible for him to find work as a writer. Ironically, as a veteran who served in World War I and World War II, Hammett is now buried at Arlington National Cemetery. End footnote. 7. Penthouse Apartment, Manila Hotel, Manila, Philippines, February 22, 1945, 1100 hours. Douglas MacArthur's own little boy has been residing safely in Australian exile, but is soon to return to the liberated Philippines with his mother. The Japanese Army's brutal 3-year reign over the islands is not yet over, but the capital city of Manila is now under attack by the United States Army. Jean MacArthur and 7-year-old Arthur will not be going back to the lavish penthouse the family once called home, for as Douglas MacArthur now sees with his own eyes, this cherished site of so many fond memories has been burned to a husk. The general smokes his favorite pipe as he steps over the blood-soaked corpse of a Japanese colonel. The ruins of the apartment still smolder. The Japanese used it as a command post, then set it ablaze in a final act of vengeance as the Americans fought their way up the stairs. On the shelves, MacArthur's vaunted collection of military history books is now ashes. In the sitting room, the family's grand piano is charred and smoking. Valuable silverware has been stolen, and next to the dead colonel's body, the fragments of a precious set of ornamental vases given to MacArthur by none other than Emperor Hirohito many years before the war litter the carpet. "They had fired it," MacArthur will later write of his former home. "I watched with indescribable feelings the destruction of my fine military library, my souvenirs, my personal belongings of a lifetime." Just yesterday, his wife and son boarded the refrigerator ship British Columbia Express in Brisbane. The voyage to Manila will take 2 weeks. In that time, the general must secure a new place for his family to live. It is highly unusual to have his wife and child stay with him in a war zone, but MacArthur is a warrior who lives by the motto that it is better to seek forgiveness than to ask permission, although he mostly does neither. In almost all circumstances, even when answering to the president, Douglas MacArthur does exactly as he pleases. More than 1,000 miles away from MacArthur's scorched apartment and the ferocious battle for the control of the Philippine capital, Manila John Bazalone paces the black sand of a deadly beach. Codenamed Island X, this barren speck of volcanic rock is known to the world as Iwo Jima. It is here that Bazalone and his fellow warriors of the 5th Marine Division are pinned down. The 28-year-old sergeant is a light heavyweight boxer and consummate Marine. After being awarded the Medal of Honor 3 years ago, the hardened veteran was sent back to the United States, where he toured the country selling war bonds. He was the very image of what many Americans thought a Marine should look like: trim, square-jawed, and handsome. But Bazalone chafed at his non-combat role and successfully petitioned to return to the Pacific battlefield. Fittingly, the tattoo on Bazalone's left arm reads, "Death before dishonor." Footnote: Bazalone joined the Army in 1934 at the age of 17. He was posted to the Philippines for 3 years, enjoying it so much that he talked about it continuously, which earned him the nickname Manila John. He left the Army in 1937, but joined the Marines in 1940 when war appeared imminent. Bazalone earned his Medal of Honor at the Battle of Guadalcanal in 1942, at one point battling his way through hostile positions in order to resupply men under his command. Bazalone would also go on to be awarded the Navy Cross for his heroism on Iwo Jima. End footnote. Now, as Marines press their bodies into the black sand lining the beaches, Japanese bullets fly unabated. Yet Sergeant Bazalone stands upright, surveying the situation. The terrain slopes steeply forward from his position to a high bank directly behind the beach. Mortar shells rain down, throwing up great clouds of sand as they explode. Japanese artillery launched from a mile away atop the flat peak of Mount Suribachi pounds the Americans. Destroyed landing craft litter the beach, yet Bazalone disregards the destruction. He has come ashore in the third wave of Marines this morning and now screams for his men to move forward. "Get your butts off the beach!" he bawls in his best parade ground voice. "Move out!" But some men don't move. They can't. Dead or mortally wounded, their bodies lie still, soaking the sand with blood. Soon, Bazalone is leading some of the surviving Marines forward, away from the extreme danger of the landing zone. Machine gun fire peppers them as they labor to crest the bank. The Japanese have built elaborate concrete pillboxes and covered them with sand, not only camouflaging their positions, but also dampening the blow of any incoming artillery. Quickly surveying his position, Bazalone knows he will need a machine gun to knock out the bunker whose bullets are now killing his men. Spotting a gun crew amid the chaos and deafening noise of the explosions, he scrambles over and smacks the gunner on the back of the helmet to get his attention. "Fire on that target!" he demands. But Private First Class Chuck Tatum's gun barrel is full of sand. It will not fire. Quickly, the Marine cleans his weapon as Bazalone looks on, frustrated. In less than 30 seconds, the job is done. Tatum opens fire on the bunker, his illuminated tracer bullets showing the path. To a man, Bazalone and the Marines are tired of war. They are exhausted by intense fighting and the 6-week voyages needed to reach the next island to be captured. Yet Iwo Jima must be taken before they will finally reach the island that matters most, Kyushu, at the southernmost tip of Japan. One of its major cities is a port known for shipbuilding called Nagasaki. The question for most Marines is not how many more invasions will take place between now and the war's end, but whether they will survive to ever see their families again. Gunnery Sergeant Manila John Bazalone is newly married with everything to live for, yet he conducts himself as a man with nothing to lose. As Chuck Tatum lays down covering fire, the sergeant moves down the line, desperate to destroy the pillbox and save the lives of his men. Back in Manila, Douglas MacArthur turns to leave his former apartment, escorted by soldiers from the Army's 37th Division. Their machine gun barrels are still hot after the firefight that cleared the Japanese from the Manila Hotel. Beyond the hotel walls, the raging battle for this once beautiful city has turned into urban combat, a rarity in the Pacific Theater. 3 American Army divisions comprising 35,000 men battle a combined group of 17,000 Japanese sailors, Marines, and soldiers. For MacArthur, who has long known the transient life of a military man, Manila is as close to a hometown as any place he has ever lived. He considers the city a citadel of democracy in the East, and has been reluctant to wage all-out war to recapture it. In fact, the general initially refused to allow the aerial bombardment and bruising artillery barrages needed to dislodge the Japanese occupiers. MacArthur is cautiously optimistic. His material possessions are gone, but Jean and Arthur are on the way, and he still commands the largest army in the Pacific. Perhaps more important, MacArthur knows his military legacy remains untarnished, despite the many months it has taken to capture the Philippines. The same cannot be said for the people of Manila. They have lost not just their homes, but in many cases, also their dignity. The battle for Manila began 2 weeks ago on February 3, 1945. By February 6, MacArthur had prematurely declared the fighting over, proclaiming to the press that Manila has fallen. That was false. Even though General Tomoyuki Yamashita had ordered Japanese forces to evacuate the city, rogue elements under his command refused to obey, successfully encouraging a large group of Japanese sailors and Marines to join them in fighting the Americans to the last man. These Japanese holdouts have mined the streets. Concealed snipers shoot Americans on sight. The fighting takes place from house to house, room to room. No place is safe. Even after American troops burn the Japanese alive with flamethrowers and demolish the buildings in which they are hiding, the Japanese still find a way to attack. One American patrol is suddenly assaulted by a sword-wielding Japanese soldier who slices open the point man's skull before the Americans shoot him and his 6 companions dead. Knowing they will never win, some Japanese soldiers get drunk and then blow themselves up with hand grenades. But many more have become obsessed with brutalizing the citizens of Manila before they die. The Japanese believe their race is superior to the Filipinos. After 3 years of absolute authority over the city of Manila, they are unable to bear the thought that these lesser people will triumph. Footnote: the Army Inspector General will formally conclude that General Yamashita never intended to completely evacuate Manila. Thus, the slaughter was the consequence of a preconceived plan executed by the commander of Japanese armed forces in the Philippines under orders from higher military command in Tokyo. The Inspector General will go on to state that the reason and purpose of the Japanese in committing these many atrocities against primarily the Filipino people was because of their partiality, cooperation, and friendliness toward America and Americans. End footnote. So even as they fight MacArthur's army for control of Manila, the Japanese are systematically murdering as many innocent local residents as possible. A formal order has been issued to Japanese troops detailing how this is to be accomplished. When Filipinos are to be killed, they must be gathered into one place and disposed of in such a manner that does not demand excessive amounts of ammunition or manpower. Given the difficulties of disposing of bodies, they should be collected in houses scheduled for burning, demolished, or thrown into the river. Footnote: that order was issued at the battalion level to the renegade soldiers, sailors, and marines under the command of Admiral Sanji Iwabuchi, who had defied orders to leave Manila and instead chose to fight to the last man. However, such a formal order was a rarity for the ill-disciplined troops under Iwabuchi's command, and the majority of the killings of Filipino citizens were undertaken by small packs of men under no central authority. Iwabuchi committed suicide by hand grenade on February 26, 1945, leaving the Japanese troops without any leadership for the last week of the fighting. This only encouraged more slaughter. End footnote. Douglas MacArthur's rationale for not allowing aerial bombardment of Manila is that the lives of innocent civilians will be endangered. Yet the horrors being inflicted upon the Filipino people defy description. Instant death from a bomb might be preferable to the agonizing murders being perpetrated by the Japanese. These war crimes are heinous, even by the Imperial Army's own gruesome standards. In the weeks to come, from February 25th to April 9th, U.S. Army war crimes investigators will interrogate eyewitnesses and report on these barbaric acts in detail. Witnesses will be interviewed in hospitals, refugee camps, and their own homes. Claims of injury and dismemberment will be verified with photographs taken in the presence of U.S. Army nurses and doctors. Cases of rape are always verified by two eyewitnesses. With bureaucratic efficiency and matter-of-fact detail, these reports will permanently document the barbarity of the Japanese military during the Battle of Manila. One report recounts, "On 11 February 1945, at about 6 p.m., just after Mr. Lim Kinog Tiang, Chinese, age 23, a grocer, had closed his store, the Japanese came and brought over 100 Filipinos and Chinese who were all tied up. The Japanese covered the eyes of the men by taking strips of cloth and blindfolding them. The victims were then taken in groups of 10 upstairs and had their heads cut off." And another: "In the early part of February 1945, at about 7 p.m., a group of Japanese, most of them officers, came to the house of Miss Asuncion Marvas, 239 San Marcelino, Manila. Miss Marvas and the members of her family were taken to the German Club. There were an estimated 500 people assembled there. When anyone attempted to leave the building, they were shot or hand grenades were thrown at them. Most of the people were killed because the place was burned. Miss Marvas wanted to go away, but the Japanese stabbed her in the buttocks. She was lying on her face or stomach at the time they stabbed her." Other war crimes reports detail what the Japanese did to Filipino children. Soldiers gouged their eyes from their skulls and threw the innocent kids against walls until their bodies broke apart. Annoyed by the children's screams, some Japanese soldiers murdered them by swinging their heads against trees. As the official United States Army investigators will soon document, every day brings brutal new terrors to the Filipino people. On Iwo Jima, American Marines are experiencing Japanese terror as well. Nippon fighters are deadly effective with their bayonets. Sergeant John Bazalone, however, finds the flamethrower to be a suitable antidote. He directs Corporal William Pegg to pour fire on the besieged Japanese pillbox. Pegg is a mountain of a man, well over 200 pounds, and wields the flamethrower with ease. As napalm enters the small gun openings in the concrete, setting the men inside ablaze, Bazalone unhooks PFC Tatum's machine gun from its tripod and runs toward the bunker. Tatum sprints at his side, clutching the ammo belt. "Bazalone's eyes had a fury I had never seen before," Tatum will later write. "Rigid, hard-clenched jaw, sweat glistening on his forehead. He was not an executioner, but a soldier performing his duty." Bazalone and Tatum make it to the bunker. Then they wait, even as distant Japanese gunners now focus their aim on the two Americans exposed atop the pillbox. But Bazelon and Tatum don't wait for long. 8 Japanese soldiers, their bodies on fire, rush out the back entrance. Firing from the hip, Bazelon mows them down. Mercy killing, Tatum thinks to himself, noting that the Japanese bodies were already coated in fiery napalm. Fearing for his life, Tatum turns to race back to the safety of the Marine lines, but Bazelon stops him. The sergeant can see a distant bunker's location on the edge of Iwo Jima's airstrip and is convinced it is a perfect strategic position. "You're staying here come hell or high water," he coolly tells Tatum. "I'm going back to get more Marines, and we're going to fight our way across this island." Then John Bazelon hands Chuck Tatum the machine gun and sprints back to the lines, ignoring the bullets whizzing all around him. In the meantime, U.S. Navy vessels are firing from offshore, pounding the Japanese artillery atop Mount Suribachi. This allows the men under John Bazelon's command to move forward. But suddenly, some of the Japanese naval ordnance descends on them. The Marines hit the dirt. Throughout the war, Marines and Army soldiers who fight on the ground grouse about how good life is for their naval peers, with their hot meals and clean living conditions aboard ships. Even some sailors are sheepish about their way of life in comparison to the fighting men on the islands. From the safety of their ships offshore of Iwo Jima, in the words of one young naval officer, the sailors could just watch the war going on. Through the glasses, I could see the tanks trying to get through the sand and not having a whole lot of luck, and see Marines diving into foxholes. But life at sea can also be very dangerous. Japanese kamikaze pilots have proven adept at weaving through anti-aircraft fire to fly their bomb-laden planes into American vessels. Footnote. Faced with growing American military superiority in the Pacific and a lack of aircraft carriers and experienced pilots, the Japanese began utilizing suicide missions in the fall of 1944. There was no lack of Japanese personnel willing to volunteer. A plane piercing a ship's hull not only tore open a gaping hole, but spread fire and explosions that killed American sailors and destroyed aircraft. Official numbers vary, but at least 47 ships were sunk by kamikazes, including 14 destroyers and 3 aircraft carrier escorts. Almost 5,000 American and British sailors were killed in the attacks, and another 5,000 wounded. The number of dead Japanese pilots stands at almost 4,000. Coming so close to the end of the war, the attacks promoted a genuine hatred for the enemy among the newly endangered sailors, many of whom were already dreaming of returning home. The attacks largely came to an end when a lack of pilots and airplanes made it impossible to continue, though they did not cease altogether. The last kamikaze attack took place on August 15, 1945. End footnote. The escort carrier Bismarck C and the Lexington-class aircraft carrier Saratoga will both be targeted during the fight for Iwo Jima. While Saratoga will suffer damage and stay afloat, Bismarck C will sink. The first kamikaze that strikes plows through the hangar deck and explodes the ship's ordnance. The second kamikaze hits the Bismarck C's elevator shaft, destroying its firefighting system in the process. 318 men are burned to death, scalded by exploding boilers, or set ablaze in oily waters as Bismarck Sea settles to the bottom of the Pacific. 600 more sailors agonize in the water for up to 12 long hours, repeatedly attacked by sharks before being picked up by other nearby vessels. Before the Marine landing, the Navy bombarded Iwo Jima for 3 days. More than 450 ships are massed offshore, including the battleships USS Texas, USS Tennessee, USS Nevada, and USS Idaho, each of which now shells the island. Tennessee alone has 12 14-inch guns, 16 5-inch guns, 40 anti-aircraft guns, and 41 cannons. She will fire more than 8,000 rounds of artillery over the course of the 3-week battle for Iwo Jima. But it is not sailors who choose the targets during battle. Instead, Marines known as forward observers radio back to the ships with precise firing instructions. Sometimes the enemy is so close that the men on board the ship can hear Japanese soldiers yelling in the background. I've lost his name, unfortunately. Young Naval Officer Ben Bradley will later remember of the Marine Lieutenant calling in the naval bombardment. One day he will become famous as the editor of the Washington Post, but for now he is just another young American trying to survive the war. He would ask for gunfire in such and such place, often within a few yards of his foxhole, and I would relay the coordinates he gave me to the gunnery officer. First, fire, then deafening explosion, then pause, while the 57-pound shells streaked toward their target, followed by comments from our unseen buddy. Fan-fucking-tastic, or bullseye, maybe. Often, even. And sometimes, I was a little close, friends. Back off a blonde one. Footnote. A slang term for an artillery coordinate. End footnote. As John Bazelon moves his men into position, they are actually in front of the forward observers. This places them in extreme danger. "Bring back the men on this side!" Bazelon yells to one squad as he scrambles to keep his fighting force in the most ideal strategic location. The machine guns, flamethrowers, and carbines carried by his unit are no match for the Japanese big guns high atop the mountain. "You're too far out front! I'm going back to get a tank or something to see if we can get some artillery in here!" As if bulletproof, Bazelon sprints away under the fusillade of shells raining down from both directions. Beneath him, the ground rises and falls as mortars and artillery explode. Back in Manila, inhumane acts against civilians continue and war crimes investigators gather testimonies. Mrs. Esther Garcia Moras reports in horrific detail. "On 9 February 1945 at 7 p.m., fires were started in the Ermita section near our home. We went out of our houses. The Japanese separated the men from the women and children. I estimate that there were about 6,000 women and children in Plaza Ferguson near the Bayview Hotel. They separated the Filipinas from the mestizas and the young girls from the older women and took the mestizas into the hotel. About 25 girls ranging in age from 13 to 27 years were placed in one room and given food, whiskey, and cigarettes. They were allowed to eat and drink in the room, and for about 20 minutes there was nobody else present. Afterwards, a group of three or four soldiers came into the room, and each took a girl from the room, including one of my two sisters, aged 14, who was returned to the room by the soldiers when they found she was having a menstrual period. Afterwards, they took my other sister, who later came back and said the Japanese had attacked her by having her take off all her clothes and making her lie on the floor and then raping her. One of the girls tried to resist, but she was slapped. Each soldier did it only once, but there were an average of four different soldiers per girl. My sister did her best to resist, but she and others could do nothing. She told all to everyone in the room. The Japanese soldiers would come in with candies and choose the girl they wanted. There were similar groups of girls in other rooms. I estimated at least five or six, making a total of about 100 girls. Nothing was done to Louis Tani, age 24, as the soldiers found that she had a defect on her, that she was so small that they could not do anything to her. Gloria Gelzi was another girl, age 15, but the names of others are not known. After taking my sister, one Japanese returned and took me. He took me to a room and locked the door. He tore my dress and my pants. He threw me on the floor and did it. It hurt me. I screamed and shouted and tried to push him off, but in vain. He was about 5 feet 6 inches tall. About 12 or 15 different ones took me. The last one was so large that he hurt me. I actually bled. He took all of my clothes and put me on a bed. He kept me there about a half hour, raping me several times. One girl was pregnant about 8 months or more, and they started to take her out. They did nothing to her because she kicked them. We stayed in the Bayview Hotel 3 days without food or water, but they only raped us that one night. When the building was on fire, they told us to go away. We could not go home because our house was burned. We kept running about in Arkisa Street. No medical attention was given any of the girls. My sister was very badly hurt because she started to bleed as it was the first time anyone did that to her. They did it to her 4 times. We tried to take her to a doctor, but we couldn't. However, I saw a Filipino doctor about 4 days ago. He examined me and told me that I had a venereal disease. My sister also has a venereal disease from the raping. I would like to have my name and address and that I testified not told to anyone. The name of Mrs. Mora's sister who was also raped is Priscilla Garcia, and the sister who was not raped because she was having a menstrual period was Evangeline Garcia. Footnote: Report of Investigation of Alleged Atrocities by Members of the Japanese Imperial Forces in Manila and Other Parts of Luzon, Philippine Islands. The report is produced here complete with grammatical and punctuation errors. The Bayview and Manila hotels are still in business. End footnote. Sergeant John Bazalone surely has seen his share of Japanese atrocities on the battlefield. It is 10:30 in the morning as the sergeant runs back to where Chuck Tatum has been ordered to hold his position at the edge of the Iwo Jima airfield. Unable to find a large number of reinforcements, Bazalone has just 3 men at his side. But they will be enough. Bazalone's heroism is his final statement on Earth. He can clearly see Tatum near the Japanese bunker. As he and his 3 men run toward the bunker, all hell breaks loose. "He was 75 yards from me, less than a football field," Chuck Tatum will later remember. "I heard the incoming mortar shell come in. That mortar shell hit right by Bazalone and the other Marines." Tatum, who will be promoted to lead the company in Bazalone's absence later that day, will describe the sergeant's demise vividly. "I didn't see anyone moving. I knew they were all dead. That's when I realized we had lost Bazalone. Word went down the line from hole to hole. They got Bazalone." Footnote: While eyewitnesses have testified that Bazalone was killed by a mortar round, the official Marine Corps cause of death was small arms fire. End footnote. The date is February 19, 1945. The Battle of Iwo Jima will continue for 5 more weeks. In addition to Manila John Bazalone, 6,820 other Americans will die. Almost 21,000 Japanese soldiers also die or go missing in action. This is virtually their entire garrison, yet Japan is no closer to surrender. The SS British Columbia Express chugs into Manila's harbor just 2 days after the city is finally liberated from the Japanese. The date is March 6th, a Tuesday. General Douglas MacArthur rides out to meet the ship in a small boat. His landing craft is an unusual choice of launch. The utilitarian barge is normally meant to deliver men and materiel into combat, not ferry a 5-star general to reunite with his long-absent wife and son. Footnote: Designed by New Orleans boatbuilder Andrew Higgins, these landing craft featured a shallow draft and ramp at the bow that was lowered once the boat reached dry land, allowing troops to run straight onto a beachhead. No less a military strategist than Adolf Hitler recognized the value of the Higgins boats utilized at the D-Day invasion, calling Higgins the new Noah. The LCVP, landing craft, vehicles, and personnel, was able to deliver 36 men plus 8,000 pounds of cargo and vehicles into a combat zone. Though used by American troops in amphibious landings in both the European and Pacific theaters of war, its plywood sides and rear gave it little defensive capability. There is a legend that when Higgins first developed the eponymous boat years before the war, they were intended to help bootleggers land their cargoes of illicit liquor. End footnote. The warm tropical air smells of diesel fuel from the 225-horsepower engine, which musters a speed of just 12 knots. MacArthur is emotional. He has not seen Jean or young Arthur in 5 months. The tough 65-year-old general's devotion to his family can often bring him to the edge of tears. He knows that the Manila his family will soon see is not the city from which they fled 3 years ago. They will be shocked. Yet Manila is free. Jean awaits her husband on deck, clutching a set of clean bedsheets, not knowing if the family will need them. Arthur stands at her side, immaculately dressed. Douglas MacArthur scrambles up a ladder and is piped aboard. He wraps his arms around his wife and son, in full view of his three aides and the sailors on deck crowding to get a view of this famous general. Having witnessed the devastation of Manila and knowing the horrors endured by its people, Douglas MacArthur is more grateful than ever that his family is safe. He pulls Jean and Arthur tight against his chest, and he does not let go for a very long time. 8. Tokyo, Japan, March 10, 1945, 12:08 a.m. Annihilation approaches as a hard northwesterly gale lashes Tokyo. An attacking wave of B-29 bombers flies low over the city. The Biko, as the Japanese have nicknamed America's most powerful aircraft, drop a small number of conventional bombs, then make the long turn south toward the Bosō Peninsula. It has been almost 3 hours since the first air raid sirens wailed over the blacked-out city. Tokyo has been largely untouched since the Americans began bombing Japan 4 months ago, so few citizens have bothered to leave their wood and paper homes for the safety of air raid shelters on this clear and cold night. As the B-29s drone into the distance, the nervous people of Tokyo feel confident enough to settle down to sleep. 7 minutes later, that confidence is shattered. The mournful yowl of the sirens once again floats over the city. This time, Tokyo's residents race for concrete shelters, all too aware that a second air raid siren is confirmation that a brutal bombardment is imminent. The shelters hold just 5,000 people, but hundreds of thousands desperately run through the streets, fathers, wives, children, grandparents, pregnant women. Many wear packs strapped to their backs that contain their vital possessions. Worried that they may not make it to the shelters in time, fathers instruct their families to take refuge in any place that offers concealment. They throw their bodies into trenches, canals, and hastily dug holes in the ground. Some gape at the sky, where spotlights sweep back and forth to illuminate the sky for anti-aircraft gunners. The moon is a crescent as the B-29s approach the heavily populated Johto district, home to 40,000 people per square mile. The observant among them realize that the planes are flying thousands of feet lower than usual. American planes typically attack from an altitude of more than 5 miles high. These B-29s are just a mile above the city. Inside the American aircraft, an adrenaline rush wipes out the monotony of the long flight to Tokyo. It has been 7 hours since the Americans took off from bases on Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. 334 aircraft of the 21st Bomber Command have flown 1,500 miles over open ocean to drop their payloads. To make room for an extra ton of bombs, each plane has been stripped of machine guns and ammunition, leaving these superfortresses vulnerable to Japanese fighter aircraft. The pilots and navigators were shocked when informed of this decision during their briefing. The order is a calculated gamble on the part of American Commander General Curtis LeMay, a 38-year-old career aviator considered belligerent and brutal by some, but widely revered for his tactical brilliance. With the deadly battle for Iwo Jima still raging, he believes that crushing the will of the Japanese people is now more important than simply bombing military targets. Footnote. Known as Big Cigar by the men under his command, LeMay instituted many bombing strategies that would be used for decades to come. The Ohioan was known for subjecting air crews to intense training, but never asked them to do something he would not do himself. While flying B-17s in the European theater of operations early in the war, LeMay insisted on piloting the lead plane over dangerous targets, subjecting his aircraft to the most intense enemy anti-aircraft fire. Men who chose to abort the missions out of fear were subject to court-martial. End footnote. LeMay's gamble pays off. Few Japanese pilots can be scrambled to confront the air invaders, leaving the B-29s free to drop their ordnance with patient precision. Some Japanese aviators are afraid, unaware that the formidable armada has been stripped of the machine guns that might shoot them down. Harsh winds also give the American bombers an unexpected form of cover, distorting radio and radar signals. The Imperial Japanese Navy picked up the incoming flights more than 1,000 miles out to sea, but due to a combination of the winds and a lack of communication between the Navy and Army, their warnings never make it to the Japanese night fighter squadrons stationed on the Kanto Plain outside Tokyo. At precisely 1 a.m., the bomb bay doors open. 14 minutes later, Tokyo is ablaze. It is a holocaust. The B-29s drop special M-69 firebombs from the belly of each fuselage. These are quite different from the atomic fission bombs being developed in Los Alamos, New Mexico, but on this night, they are far more deadly. This firebombing of Tokyo, known as Operation Meeting House, is the most horrific bombing in history, far deadlier than the recent Dresden attacks or any other bombing of the Second World War. Footnote: the Dresden bombings in Germany on February 13th through 15th, 1945, were a catastrophic slaughter of civilians. Allied bombers dropped 3,900 tons of bombs, killing somewhere between 35,000 and 100,000 people and leveling 4 square miles of the city. The firebombing of Tokyo killed 4 times as many and destroyed a much larger swath of the city. The most well-known among civilian bombings during the war, the German Blitz of London from September 1940 to May 1941, saw 45,000 tons of bombs dropped on the city, with the loss of 1 million homes and 45,000 civilian casualties. End footnote. The use of mass aerial bombardment in World War II forever alters how future conflicts will be waged. The atomic device, which will use elements like uranium in order to create a single explosion of extraordinary intensity, has yet to be tested. The M69 used on the people of Tokyo is a 20-inch steel pipe packed with the jellied gasoline known as napalm, which constitutes the Esso Corporation's most important contribution to the American war effort. The M69s are bundled into clusters of 38, which are then loaded inside a finned casing and dropped from the aircraft. 2,000 feet above the ground, the casing opens, releasing the bombs and allowing them to plummet to the earth separately. Nothing happens immediately upon impact, but 3 seconds later, a timed fuse ignites a white phosphorus charge, which forces the napalm to shoot out of the 3-inch-wide pipe. Slow-burning and sticky, the napalm affixes itself to clothing, hair, and skin, burning straight down to the bone. One M69 is capable of starting a massive fire. 1 ton of M69s will ensure complete destruction. On the morning of March 10, 1945, American B-29 bombers dropped 2,000 tons of M69 napalm bombs on Tokyo. Driven by winds of nearly hurricane force, fire envelops entire city blocks. Mobs of Japanese citizens race for their lives, only to be surrounded by the inferno and summarily asphyxiated as the flames suck all the oxygen from the air. Water mains are destroyed by the blaze, rendering fire hoses useless. Crews armed with water buckets are helpless to stop the carnage. 80 firefighters and more than 500 volunteers refuse to leave their posts and burn to death where they stand. Flames destroy 96 fire engines. Orange tongues of fire shoot so high from the ground that they reflect off the underbellies of the silver bombers overhead. As the heat rises, updrafts reach thousands of feet high, actually bringing the smell of burning human flesh into the nostrils of the American pilots. Many planes return to their home base with their fuselages coated in soot. Soon, fire consumes 16 square miles of Tokyo. The entire geisha district is turned to ash. Hospitals, homes, temples, train stations, bus depots, convents, theaters, fire stations, workers' hospitals, and schools are destroyed. From the safety of the Imperial Palace, which the Americans have specifically chosen not to bomb, Emperor Hirohito beholds a red glow across the horizon, turning darkest night into day. Trapped inside walls of flame that throw off unimaginably high temperatures, citizens spontaneously burst into flames. Debris flies through the air, striking people dead at random. City canals boil. Dead bodies bob in the icy rivers. Charred corpses litter the ground, many still burning due to body oils. The heat takes its toll on the living as well, melting faces, fingers, and toes. Skin literally peels off bodies hanging in great flaps from torsos. At 3:20 a.m., the bombing stops. As dawn rises over Tokyo, one-fourth of the city has been destroyed. 100,000 people are dead. 40,000 people are badly burned but alive. 1 million Japanese are homeless. Of the 324 B-29s that carried out the bombings, just 12 planes were lost, mainly due to engine failures. General Curtis LeMay's stated goal for this mission was that Tokyo be burned down and wiped off the map to shorten the war. Emperor Hirohito tours the burned-out portions of Tokyo on March 18th. His caravan of vehicles and his own maroon Rolls-Royce carry the official chrysanthemum crest, signifying that a gyoko, a blessed visitation, is taking place. He comes upon exhausted citizens pawing through rubble, searching for some fragment of their former lives. Upon seeing his vehicles, instead of adopting a subservient stance, the people glare. Hirohito does not stop the cars to engage his subjects, nor does his facial expression display sorrow or regret. Despite the war weariness so evident among Tokyo's citizens, Japan's elite will send an emissary to Hirohito 2 days later, imploring him not to surrender. It is their belief that the Japanese people will become used to the bombings and grow closer together in the process. In the weeks that follow, Japanese citizens lose sleep, staying up late to prepare for yet another bombing attack and leaving them exhausted and distraught. There is a rise in absenteeism in factories and a slowing of the nation's war production. Yet the Japanese still will not surrender. Not even when General LeMay repeats the same firebombing in Nagoya, Yokohama, Osaka, Kobe, and Kawasaki. Instead, schools in Japan close. As a sign that the nation will fight to the bitter end, all children are put to work producing food or munitions. Some are even taught how to operate anti-aircraft guns. But that won't be necessary. After 2 weeks of burn jobs, the firebombing of Japan comes to an end. There are two reasons. First, LeMay's pilots are exhausted. And second, after dropping 5 million M-69s on Japan, the 21st Command has run out of firebombs. 9. Room H-128, Capitol Building, Washington, D.C., April 12, 1945, 5 p.m. A light rain falls on the nation's capital as Harry Truman strides into a high-ceilinged room, thirsty for a drink. The vice president wears a gray suit with a white handkerchief folded in his breast pocket. Even after a long day presiding over the Senate, Truman appears dapper and polished. As he enters room H-128 on the ground floor of the Capitol to enjoy Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn's nightly happy hour, Truman is content and at ease. Tomorrow, as he wrote to his mother just a few moments ago during a particularly long speech by a windy senator from Wisconsin, he will deliver a national radio address on Thomas Jefferson Day, the anniversary of the third president's birth. Other than that, he doesn't have much on his mind. "Harry, Steve Early wants you to call him right away," Congressman Rayburn says the instant Truman steps through the door. The large room housed the Committee on Territories back in the 19th century, and the ceiling is painted with a mural celebrating America's expansion. At Rayburn's urging, the Lone Star of Texas was recently added to the collection of painted birds and plants. Otherwise, the room resembles a very comfortable men's club. The 63-year-old Rayburn has been speaker for 5 years and often uses these nightly booze meetings he has dubbed the Board of Education as a means of building coalitions to support bills or simply to strategize. Invitations are extended according to Rayburn's political needs. Attending the Board of Education once or twice in a term is considered to be a status symbol. Some, however, like Truman and Texas Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson, can stop by for two fingers of bourbon and branch water anytime they like. Truman picks up the phone and dials National 1414, the phone number for President Roosevelt's longtime press secretary Steve Early. Calls from the White House are rare, and Truman still has not been vice president long enough to have penetrated FDR's inner circle. So even though the president is at his Warm Springs, Georgia hideaway recuperating from the long journey back from Yalta, Truman is quick to answer Early's message in case something important is required of him. So far in his term, that has not been the case. "This is the VP," Truman says at the sound of Early's voice. Early gets to the point. "Come to the White House as quickly and quietly as you can." "Jesus Christ and General Jackson," Truman exclaims, replacing the phone. "I am wanted at the White House right away," he tells Rayburn. As Truman steps out the door, he realizes he has left his hat behind in his office. He walks each day for exercise, maintaining a brisk pace of 120 steps per minute. But now, Harry Truman begins to run. He dashes the length of the Capitol building, his footsteps echoing off the marble floor. He wonders if Roosevelt has decided to cut short his trip to Georgia, or if there is some special errand pertaining to the Congress that the president requires of him. The two men have met in person just twice, so any summons from the president has a tone of urgency. Truman senses that Roosevelt is angry with him, though he does not know why. This only increases his desire to get to the White House as soon as possible. By 5:25 p.m., the vice president's car is parked beneath the north portico of the White House. Truman steps out and is escorted inside by two ushers. One of them guides him to a small oak-paneled elevator. Nothing is said. Truman still has no idea why he has been summoned. Stepping out from the elevator on the second floor, he is surprised to see Eleanor Roosevelt and her daughter Anna wearing black dresses. Truman's relationship with the First Lady has been wary and strained, so she would never summon him for social reasons, let alone invite him up to her personal study. Footnote: Eleanor Roosevelt had been very fond of Truman's predecessor, Henry Wallace, and was firmly against his removal from the ticket. Truman first met Eleanor at a White House reception in 1935, shortly after he was elected to the Senate. He thought her to be condescending. Between then and 1945, Truman had criticized her to family members, saying that she was too fond of the public eye and the sound of her own voice. End footnote. Quickly, Truman realizes why he has been summoned. "Harry," the now former First Lady tells him, "the president is dead." Her voice is calm, for she has known for more than an hour. The marriage between Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt has lasted 40 years, but it is largely one of political convenience. FDR was known to stray. Indeed, the cerebral hemorrhage that finally killed him in Georgia took place in the presence of his mistress, Lucy Mercer Rutherford. "Is there anything I can do for you?" Truman asks Eleanor as the truth sinks in. The First Lady looks directly at the new president. "Is there anything we can do for you? For you are the one in trouble now." The time is 7:09 p.m. A stunned Harry S. Truman places his left hand on a red-edged Bible and raises his right. His wife and daughter, 9 cabinet members, 6 congressional leaders, several members of the White House staff, and a handful of reporters are crammed into the cabinet room. Everyone is standing. A portrait of Woodrow Wilson, Truman's favorite president, overlooks the proceedings as Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone of the Supreme Court recites the oath of office. "I, Harry Shipp Truman," begins Stone. Truman has the presence of mind to correct him. "I, Harry S. Truman," he replies. Footnote. Ship was the middle name of Harry Truman's grandfather, Anderson Ship Truman. Margaret Truman later wrote of her father's inauguration, "Where Stone got the idea that Dad's middle name was Ship, no one has ever found out." End footnote. The oath continues. Outside the cabinet room, a small army of reporters and photographers has gathered in the West Wing. News of Roosevelt's death has already flashed around the world, drawing a crowd of thousands to now stand vigil in front of the White House. "So help me God," intones Stone, bringing the oath of office to an end. "So help me God," replies President Harry S. Truman. Footnote. Originally, the words "so help me God" were not part of the oath of office. Some historians believe George Washington added them when he was inaugurated in 1789, while others argue he did not say the words, but they were later attributed to him. Either way, they have remained a presidential tradition. End footnote. The Bible on which Truman has sworn his oath is a cheap Gideon edition normally found in hotel rooms. It was all that could be found in the commotion. But now this common Bible has become a historical artifact. Outwardly, Truman shows no fear of what is to come, his face taut, in the words of one report. But the new president concludes the oath impulsively, suddenly pressing the Bible firmly to his lips in a sincere kiss. On April 24th, President Truman is briefed on the top-secret news that the United States will soon test an atomic bomb. "Within 4 months," begins the report brought to Truman in the Oval Office, "we shall, in all probability, have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city. If successful, this weapon could end the Pacific War, though at great loss of life to civilians. Hundreds of thousands, if not more than 1 million, Japanese citizens may die." One day after that, Truman authorizes the wholesale invasion of Japan by American forces. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers are expected to perish if the attack is finally given the go. The invasion of Japan, however, might be unnecessary if the A-bomb is ready. The final decision about dropping the bomb will be made solely by Truman, though at this point, he is not sure what the A-bomb really is. But Truman knows that the bleeding of American lives needs to stop. Japan must be crushed. 10. Los Alamos, New Mexico, April 22, 1945, 5 p.m. The most dangerous man in the world is celebrating his 41st birthday. Sipping on a dry gin martini, the eccentric and brilliant physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer moves from conversation to conversation in the living room of his 1,200-square-foot stone and wood cottage. The air smells like pipe tobacco. His guests are physicists, chemists, and Nobel Prize winners, their accents British, American, and Eastern European. Footnote. The great Albert Einstein was not among them. The theoretical scientist's pacifist views have made him a security risk. With the exception of some minor work for the U.S. Navy, Einstein has been virtually shut out of the war effort. End footnote. Everyone in the room has a top-secret security clearance, allowing them to speak freely about a topic few in the world are aware of. With Germany all but defeated, these brilliant minds are divided between those who want to see the atomic bomb dropped on Japan and those who believe it is morally wrong to destroy a country so near to surrender. Some believe that dropping the A-bomb will lead to a worldwide arms race. Indeed, the Hungarian physicist Leo Szilard is making secret plans to meet with President Truman to discuss this troubling matter in person. Footnote. Szilard will be thwarted in his efforts to speak to Harry Truman about what he perceives to be an impending arms race. Truman believed Szilard was misguided in wanting to share the A-bomb's technology with other Allied powers. End footnote. The altitude in Los Alamos is 7,300 feet atop a desert mesa. Newcomers often find themselves unable to handle their liquor because the thin air brings dizziness. But Oppenheimer's drinking stamina is legendary among his staff, surpassed only by his obsessive drive to create the world's first atomic weapon. Even after this Sunday night of celebration, Oppenheimer will rise well before the 7:30 a.m. factory whistle blows. My two great loves, Robert Oppenheimer wrote to a friend long before the war, are physics and desert country. It's a pity they can't be combined. Now, thanks to Brigadier General Leslie Groves and the top-secret Manhattan Project, they have been. It has been 6 years since Franklin Roosevelt's Oval Office meeting with Alexander Sachs and its resulting call to action for America to pursue nuclear weapons. But it has been less than 3 years since Oppenheimer was tasked by the overweight Army bureaucrat with not only building a state-of-the-art laboratory in the middle of nowhere, but also convincing some of the world's sharpest minds to put their lives on hold to spend the rest of the war here. Oppenheimer was not the obvious choice to be in charge of the lab. His past indicated some trouble. The young professor from the University of California at Berkeley had a history of depression and eccentric behavior. In the late 1930s, Oppenheimer dated a woman known to be a member of the Communist Party, which concerned Army counterintelligence and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Also, Oppenheimer had no experience managing a large group of people, nor had he won a Nobel Prize. Many doubted that he had the experience required to build the world's first weapon of mass destruction. Yet the outspoken Groves was determined to hire him. "Oppenheimer can talk to you about anything. He can talk to you about anything you bring up. Well, not exactly. He doesn't know anything about sports," Groves would later tell an interviewer, referring to Oppenheimer as a genius. Word of a new laboratory devoted to splitting atoms eventually filtered into the scientific community. At the time of Oppenheimer's hiring in October 1942, some were shocked at the most improbable appointment. As one physicist noted, "I was astonished." A 25-year-old boys' school 35 miles northwest of Santa Fe, with log dormitories and a stunning view of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, was soon purchased to build Oppenheimer's new lab. Included in the $440,000 price were 8,900 acres of land, 60 horses, 50 saddles, and one phone line. The school, named Los Alamos, was soon ringed with security fences, topped with coils of razor wire, and guarded by military personnel and attack dogs. Oppenheimer's scientists began to feel so secure that many stopped locking their front doors when they leave for work in the morning. That safety, however, comes at a cost. Each employee at the Los Alamos National Laboratory is subject to constant monitoring of his or her personal life by security personnel. News of the atomic bomb research must be kept from reaching Germany and the Soviet Union. Footnote: even before the Manhattan Project got underway in 1942, the Soviets knew America was pursuing the bomb. Their code name for this effort was Enormaz, enormous. German-born physicist Klaus Fuchs and American scientist Theodore Hall were both Los Alamos employees who also spied for the Russians. Fuchs was convicted as a spy in 1950 and sentenced to 14 years in prison, of which he served 9. Hall was never charged. There were many more spies within Los Alamos, though their code names are known. Their identities have never been discovered. End footnote. What began as a theoretical laboratory soon became a small town. A theater group was formed, with Oppenheimer himself making a cameo appearance as a corpse in Arsenic and Old Lace. A town council was elected. Parties were common and lasted late into the night, sometimes featuring the world's most learned minds playing piano or violin to entertain their friends. Some found the remote location to be claustrophobic, while others thought it romantic, leading to an extraordinarily high birth rate. As 1944 becomes 1945 and the testing of an actual A-bomb begins, The physical and emotional toll of transforming a weapon that once existed only in theory into a violent force that could end the largest war in history has been debilitating. Oppenheimer stands almost 6 feet tall, but has wasted away to just 115 pounds. His teeth are rotting. He smokes 5 packs of Chesterfield cigarettes a day and is prone to long fits of smoker's cough that turn his face purple. He rarely eats, having abandoned his passion for spicy food in favor of a diet of gin, cigarettes, and coffee. Worse, Oppenheimer's wife of 5 years, Kitty, a genius in her own right in the field of botany, has broken under the strain. She has gone home to live with her parents in Pittsburgh, taking their 4-year-old son Peter with her. Strangely, Kitty leaves their 4-month-old daughter Tony behind. Knowing that Oppenheimer will not be able to care for the baby, she has entrusted the child to Pat Scher, a good friend who has just suffered a miscarriage. The truth is that Kitty has never been a good mother to Tony, whom she sees as an unwanted burden, frequently abandoning her to the company of friends for days at a time. Robert Oppenheimer visits his daughter twice a week, though his own love for his daughter is just as precarious as that of his wife. Juggling parenting and the upcoming testing of the atomic bomb is too much for him. On one occasion, he asks Scher if she would like to adopt Tony, explaining that he just can't love her. An appalled Scher declines. Robert Oppenheimer longs for Kitty's return. She is his sole confidant and one of the few people he can trust. Footnote. Known for her fiery, outspoken ways, Catherine Poenning Oppenheimer returned to Los Alamos to be with her husband in July 1945. He was not her first spouse. In fact, she had been wed 3 times before marrying Robert Oppenheimer on November 1, 1940. Among her past husbands was a known Communist Party member who died while fighting in the Spanish Civil War. This led FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to investigate her loyalty to the United States in 1944. She was cleared of all charges. Kitty and Robert Oppenheimer remained married for the rest of his life, years that included frequent marital fighting and her downward spiral into alcoholism. End footnote. Yet in Kitty's absence, there are rumors. Despite his cadaverous look and the smell of stale tobacco that clings to him like a shroud, some women are drawn to Oppenheimer. He is not oblivious to their charms. Talk of affairs follows him throughout his time at Los Alamos. Among the rumors, although it appears to have been nothing more than that, is one of a liaison with a pretty blonde 20-year-old secretary, Ann T. Wilson, whom Oppenheimer handpicked for the job upon meeting her in Washington. Oppenheimer's relations with other women, however, go far beyond rumor. In June 1943, he rekindled an old romance with pediatric psychologist Jean Tatlock while on a business trip to Berkeley. Army intelligence agents who were spying on Oppenheimer's every move due to the high security surrounding the Manhattan Project reported that he had dinner and drinks with Tatlock before spending the night in her apartment. Years before, in the midst of a torrid relationship, Tatlock had turned down Oppenheimer on 3 separate occasions when he asked her to marry him. It was a decision she would come to regret by 1943. 6 months after Oppenheimer spent the night, Jean Tatlock drew a bath, swallowed a bottle of sleeping pills, and died. Another of Oppenheimer's affairs is with Ruth Tolman, a psychologist for the Office of Strategic Services who is 10 years older than Oppenheimer. This affair will continue long after the war's end. Tolman's husband is also employed at Los Alamos and soon learns of his wife's infidelity. When Ruth's husband Richard dies of a heart attack in 1948, some will claim that despondence over his wife's love of Oppenheimer was a primary cause. Right now, however, Robert Oppenheimer has little energy to stray. His gadget, as he calls the A-bomb, is almost ready for testing. The detonation, when it occurs, will take place in the nearby desert, the Jornada del Muerto, or Journey of the Dead Man, as this barren, wind-swept landscape is appropriately known. The site has been chosen because it is remote, unpopulated, and flat. Robert Oppenheimer graduated from Harvard with honors in just 3 years and has a PhD in physics from Germany's University of Göttingen. He is a natural leader who enjoys the spotlight but rarely shows his true emotions. Among his varied interests, Oppenheimer is a believer in Eastern philosophy. His code name for the upcoming A-bomb test is Trinity, after the three Hindu gods Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Footnote: the gods are collectively known as Trimurti in Sanskrit, meaning having three forms. This is coincidentally close to Trinity. Later in life, Oppenheimer will also state that the name came from the sonnets of John Donne and the line, "Batter my heart, three-personed God." End footnote. Oppenheimer can quote the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, at will. "If the radiance of 1,000 suns were to burst into the sky, that would be like the splendor of the Mighty One. Now I am become death, the shatterer of worlds." Footnote: Hindu scholars say the passage refers to the god Vishnu, who is trying to persuade a prince to do his duty. Vishnu quotes the line about being a destroyer of worlds while trying to impress the prince with his power by transforming himself into a being with several arms. End footnote. As his birthday party progresses, Oppenheimer shakes another martini with great flair. The cocktail is one of his personal trademarks. Although he drinks constantly, the scientist prefers to sip his libation slowly and rarely becomes inebriated. Robert Oppenheimer's life is full of contradiction. But, as his favorite selection from the Bhagavad Gita suggests, this man who chose to play a corpse on stage and whose body now wastes away as he deprives it of simple nourishment is a real-life grim reaper. And he knows it.